What do you do when your script is too similar to another script idea? Hello, I'm Jason Inman, and this is Mythmakers, a writing podcast. My goal is to interview writers, actors, and creators on some of their favorite stories to dive deep and learn with you more about their storytelling process. I think how people contemplate their favorite movies and television gives us a mirror into their creative process, into how they make modern myths, if you will. Today's guest is Mark Reilly. Now, many people know him as Yodi on the movie trivia Schmodown on Collider, but he's also an accomplished writer, having won many screenwriting contests that you'll hear about on today's episode. So let's dive deep and let's talk some story. Okay, Mark, you are the first guest of this podcast. Thank you for breaking the seal.
I love it. I love being the first guest, and I am actually very honored to be the first guest
with you, my friend. Yeah. All right, so before we get into your favorite characters of fiction and your favorite books and things like that, I want to ask you, what is your writing process? What works best for you? Are you a night writer, a morning writer, or do you like to just do it once a week? What is your writing process?
My writing process is all over the place, depending on work and work schedule, but I usually try to write every day after work. If I get home around 6:30 or 7, I usually try to put in at least an hour.
Okay, and by that, is it just the time function? You're just like, okay, I'm going to write an hour, or do you have a word count or a page count?
I don't have a word count or a page count. Okay. I have a time, because it's usually like I have only about an hour before I need to get fed. Mm-hmm. I need to tie up some loose ends with work, to hang out with my girlfriend, at the end of the day. So when I get home, I usually have about an hour to myself. So that's when I try to actually write. It's the weekends that I tend to try to do more and do a page count. So like weekends on a Saturday or a Sunday, I'll try to get at least 3 pages.
Oh, nice, nice. So, you're very disciplined. I like that. And this is something important.
Trying.
You might be hearing Mark's washer dryer in the background.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Imagine that as a ticking clock for him to get his page count for today.
Exactly. That's the way to look at it.
So another question I want to ask you is just because some people might only know you from the Schmodown, some people might only know you from the Schmo's No Show.
Right.
What are your writing bona fides? Like, pimp yourself out. Let's talk about Mark. Let's talk about how good a writer you are.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, let's go back then. I started writing, pretty much right out of college, honed the craft. The biggest thing I think that kind of put me on the map for a step forward for my career was I wrote this script called Archangel, which I called Angels with the Matrix. So it's basically
was this post-Matrix as well?
Yeah, this was post-Matrix.
Okay, right.
And this was, I kind of looked at it as like, we have guardian angels out there and they're actually warriors. And we have like a very cool, gritty Matrix feel to it. And so I submitted that to the Nickel Fellowship.
Oh, yes. That's the very famous. It's
through the Academy.
Yeah, I was going to say it is through the Academy Awards.
Yeah. And so.
And they only pick 10 people a year?
Pick 10 people a year, I believe. Mm-hmm. And so I was shocked when I made it into the. I believe the quarterfinals.
What year was this?
This was in 2000 and probably 5.
Wow, man.
Yeah, a long time ago. So got into the quarterfinals and they're like, congratulations. Out of 7,000 scripts, you've been picked for the top 300. And I'm like, wow, okay, that's pretty cool. Didn't expect to get any further than that. Then I got another notice that said, you've made it to the semifinals. So out of 300, you're down to 150. And I was like, wow.
Do you get anything for the quarterfinals or the semifinals? Is it only the top prize?
It's only the top prize. Okay. You don't get anything. You get this letter that says you're cool. Keep doing what you're doing. And I'm like, okay, this is great. And so then I got into not the finals. There's one more stage. I probably did this backwards. But I made it down to the last, I believe, 100 scripts.
Wow.
And then it was going to be cut down to the 10.
Yeah.
And so I was really like, oh my God, is this going to happen?
Yeah.
I didn't make it to the 10, but what it did do was they're like, now we're going to release the list. We're going to release the
top 100?
The top 100.
Oh, nice.
So I got a manager out of that.
Really? A writing manager?
A writing manager.
And this was right out of the gate after college?
No, 2005. So I'd been out of college for like 5 years.
Okay,
almost.
Okay.
So,
but still pretty damn good.
I try. Yeah. So that was really cool. The manager got me a little bit of work. I was hired to write a script for a producer And it didn't go anywhere. Mm-hmm. You know, it was
now,
fine.
Now, can I back up a little bit?
Sure.
Did the manager contact you because of the 100 list, or did you contact the manager?
They contacted me. I actually got contact a lot. I got a lot of different managers, and I was really like,
"See, there you go, guys.
Oh, okay. This is a great process.
See, this is great because I think for a lot of people, they're always like, how do I become the screenwriter?
Yeah.
And you just gave a solution. Write a great script, get in the top 100. You'll probably get a manager out of it.
Yes. Yes. I can't actually say enough of, you know, contests, because if you can actually get pretty far in these online contests, prestigious or otherwise, it's a nice little thing on your resume.
You
right?
recently won a contest as well, and forgive me, it was the Chicago Groundlings contest. Am I correct?
Yeah,
about
it was the Second City.
Yeah, Second City.
Through Chicago.
Me.
Yeah,
I just mixed up the improv.
That's quite all right. Yeah, that was my writing partner Lisa Gottman and I wrote a comedy script, and she did the submission kind of very similar Nickel Fellowship and went,
yeah,
should we do it? And I'm like, yeah, it sounds fun. Let's do it. And then shockingly enough, we won the entire thing. So that was when we got a, not a manager, but a producer attached themselves to this script that we're still trying to figure out right now.
All right.
She kind of dropped off the face of the map, which is another part of this business. Sometimes people will ghost you.
Yes, that happens a lot.
And they will disappear and they will be very excited to work with you. Yep. And then their options or things change within their business, as the case with this producer.
Can I ask a question here?
Sure,
though?
Please.
Have you received any kind of payday? I'm not asking for specifics, but has the producer optioned it towards a paycheck for Mark Reilly?
No, not yet.
Okay.
That's the other downside. Yes, that's the other downside. It's kind of contingent on if we can get it made or get it, you know, get somebody attached, then we set up the kind of payment later on down the line. We're cool with it, but we are feeling like we're losing out. We're losing out on some options. So Lisa and I are going to
Your writing partner.
My writing partner.
What's her full name?
Lisa Gottman.
Okay.
Yeah.
How long have you worked with her?
I went to college with her.
Okay.
So I've known her for...
So she's always been your writing partner.
She hasn't always been. She's been a 20-year-old friend.
Okay.
And then we came up with this idea kind of hanging out one night, and then we started writing, and there we go. We wrote this script together. It's our first together. Actually, it's our second. I forgot about that. Right out of college, we wrote a script together, and it was ugly as hell. It was awful. It had some great ideas in it.
Like all first scripts are, man.
Yeah. And that was our learning curve, and we had always said we loved working together. It was our second script called The List that we were very, very, like, I felt like we really hit a stride.
Can you give me the elevator pitch of it?
The elevator pitch is everybody has a celebrity list.
Of who they can have sex with.
Of who they can have sex with in case they run into that person. Mm-hmm. And so our couple has been dating for many, many years, and they're kind of in a stale state.
Yep.
They're kind of, call it a 5-year, 6-year relationship where he hasn't pulled the trigger yet on marriage.
Mm.
They're kind of just very comfortable with their life. And then she runs into one of her celebrities.
Okay.
And in a drunken, debaucherous night, she wakes up at his house and doesn't know what happened.
Oh, interesting.
And so then it kind of goes from there, and they have to choose, you know, between each other or this new celebrity kind of life that's kind of thrust on them. And then it's kind of a romantic comedy.
Yeah.
By the end, they realize, you know what? No. And they get back together. So, but it's very funny.
That's a great elevator pitch.
Well, thank you.
I'd see that movie.
Okay, good. I like it. So I really like it. And so we're going to take that momentum off of this script, and we are going to write a pilot as well.
Oh, great.
So we're going to work together, and we, you know, Lisa, what I love about Lisa is that she's like, she had this idea. I'm going to respect her wishes because she wants to beat it out and know the pitch, but she came to me with a very interesting idea and with a lot of strong women characters. And that's what I love about Lisa.
Nice.
I'm like, okay, because I feel like there is a change happening in the industry, and I can't wait to kind of tap into that.
Now, before we get to picking your brains about some of your fictional characters and stuff, like, what type of writer are you? You just mentioned that your writing partner, Lisa, likes to beat everything out. Do you just like to write without anything, knowing anything? Do you got to beat out every moment? Now, myself, I have to beat out every scene.
Okay.
I want to know where we're going. And I allow within the beat sheet some, you know, turns here and there. Like,
yes.
I'll be like, oh, no, the character wouldn't do this. Character wouldn't do this. But I want that beat sheet because I feel comfortable once I have that.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of writer are you?
I am very similar. I have beat out scripts, done the beat sheet, done the treatments. One of the other projects I worked with Christian Harloff on, Masters of the Universe, and that was at Warner Brothers and Silver Pictures before they let the property lapse.
Yep.
I wrote a beat sheet, a treatment, and then we couldn't get to the script process because they turned it down. Mm-hmm. And that was, but we were working on it for a while. So that was a good example of when a treatment really worked for me. I've done everything from note cards that have scenes on it.
Oh, yeah.
Recently, though, I'm working on a script, which is a horror script. And I play in all genres. I don't really have a specific genre that I like. Maybe horror more so than not, because I made a horror movie that I wrote.
Yeah.
But so for this one, I came up with an idea. It was more of a concept in my mind. And then I started to just write what I started with this time, which was different. It's very character driven.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote pages upon pages upon pages of each character's history.
Oh, wow.
So
did you feel that you couldn't write the script without that history?
Yeah, it was something new where I was like, this is going to be my probably my most character driven script to date. Like when I mentioned the Angels and Matrix kind of thing, that was like an action thing. And so I kind of beat that out and then wrote it. For this, I'm 30 pages in and I just started writing.
And you're currently working on it right now.
I'm currently working on it right now. I just started writing after I got all those characters. Like I think each character, I think I have about six main characters. The main character, London is her name. She has probably six pages of backstory that was just like what happened to her before, like how she was literally when she was born until where we find her now. Then her mom and dad are the next two main characters, and they have probably three pages each. And then the main kind of horrific character that I am going to keep under wraps at the moment.
Oh, yeah, please, please. Yeah, if you're currently working on this, and I hope anybody that listens to this podcast as well in future episodes, if any of our writers are currently working on a project, I'm not going to ask them to spoil the idea because – not that I don't trust you, super friends, but, you know, we don't know, you know, ideas can be stolen. Like, have you ever had that? I've had this happen several times. I was working on an Aerospec 2 years ago and I had a great idea for the villain, did all this stuff up. I was like 46 pages into it. I was almost done.
Wow.
And then I saw a trailer for next week's episode of Arrow and it was my villain. And I was like, no.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's like I always think that there is actually a kind of a power out there where you can tap into this like concept and that I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, the creative conscience of the world, man. Like it aligns sometimes.
It really does. And I remember working on a script with a manager, like long story short, I ended up with a different manager years later. And I wrote a spec called the Flying Saucer Gang, and it was basically Goonies in space.
Oh, nice.
And I was working on it, and then my manager's like, this movie just got optioned. And it was a very similar pitch.
Yep.
It was almost so similar that he went, sorry, and he dropped me.
Yeah.
And I was like, you son of a bitch. and I was so upset.
Yeah.
I was crushed.
Yeah.
I still have the script. I still
And there's nothing to say you couldn't like adapt it into some other format or even take the ideas.
I thought about
you should make a comic book of it.
I know, right?
You should make a comic book.
I wanted to make. I actually have a comic book, which I'll tell you about. That's something I wrote with my writing partner, The People from Anywhere. We have two issues of it. That's a hard thing. I love that you're
comic
doing yours.
Comic books are hard, man.
Yeah,
comic books are really hard.
But you guys are gotten a lot farther than we ever did. You guys are kicking ass.
I appreciate that. All right. So let's move into the main format of this podcast. So I want to pick your brain a little bit.
Please.
I want to hear and feel and just basically understand how your writing brain works. So Mark Reilly, I want to know, who is your favorite fictional character?
Oh, I have gone back and forth. There are two that are in my head.
We can talk about both.
We can talk about both?
Yeah.
Okay. For people that know me will understand the second one. I'm going to start with the writer kind of.
For sure.
You know, yes, I look how smart I am. Sideways. Miles Raymond. Paul Giamatti's character from Sideways.
Interesting.
Is one of my favorite characters of all time. And it's slowly over probably, I would say, the past 5 years that I've become enamored with this character,
mm-hmm.
And that this movie itself has just jumped into my top five because it's just, I think it's something to do with personal experience that I went through something very similar with Miles, mm-hmm. In that I got divorced. I love wine. And
you see aspects of yourself in this character.
Yes, okay. Absolutely. And the more I watch Sideways has become a movie that my girlfriend and I just kind of put in.
Is it your comfort movie?
It's our comfort movie.
Nice.
Yeah. We're winos. We love wine tasting. We've done the Sideways trail.
Sure.
We've gone up there and done it.
Oh, do they have a specific trail up there now?
They have
since the movie?
Yeah, they have like you can go and like online and go, this is the restaurant they went to. This is the winery they did this. Like we were at a winery once on the way home from a wine tasting trip, and the guy that was pouring for Miles and Jack.
Was he in the movie?
He was in the movie. He was pouring for us. And I'm looking at my girlfriend, Julie, going, that's the guy from Sideways. So that has become.
Be honest. Did you get a picture?
Oh, yeah. We got a picture. Oh, hell yeah. I'm like, this is the guy from Sideways. This guy with the cowboy hat and the beard and long hair for those of you listening at home. So Miles has become one of my favorite characters because the way he's written, and I've read the book, too. It's one of my favorite books.
Yeah.
The way he's written, he does this long soliloquy in the movie when he's talking to Virginia Madsen's character on why do you like Pinot Noir so much? And he talks about the grape of Pinot, mm-hmm. and he's like, it's very delicate. Only the most perfect growers can handle it. It needs a lot of care. It needs a lot of attention.
Mm-hmm.
You can't like put it in a different climate. It only works in this climate. And Miles is basically talking about himself. You know, and he's telling this woman because he got divorced himself and he's telling this woman that he just met, this is what you need to do to make me grow.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like we watched it just 2 weeks ago and I was like I started to choke up again. And it's like the 50th time I've seen this movie, but to see it again. And Miles is so funny. It's like obviously he has a drinking problem. Obviously he has depression problems, but he keeps getting up and doing it and writing. And then in the middle of his trip, he gets a call from his publisher and says, they passed. And he's like, I have to start all over. I have to throw this book away that I've been doing all my life and just start over. And it's tragic, but it's like he ties it to wine and he ties it to, so he's talking to Maya.
Do you like the idea that his internal struggles are sort of tied to his external? Is that the reason why this character connects to you so much? Like what he's feeling inside, he connects to physical wine, like a physical object.
Yes.
And that's what really tracks with you?
That tracks with me. Mm-hmm. The character, the performance tracks with me. You know, the experience, you know, we both had the divorce, right? I got into wine. And I love the wine and I don't look at myself though as a Pinot grape. I connect with his experience.
Okay.
But then he has this adventure and he's so against it the entire time. He just wants to go wine tasting and play golf with his friend. And instead his friend goes off and becomes like this crazy person who tries to sleep with every woman.
Yeah,
he sees.
Thomas Hayden Church, right?
Yeah, Hayden Church. Mm-hmm. And he ends up with a girl, Sandra Oh's character, mm-hmm. and they have this relationship. And Miles is like hanging on the side going, my God, what are you doing, dude? Stop. I just want to play golf. I just want to do this. And I identify with that, meaning I identify with being lazy. I identify with I don't want to do anything. If we're going to go up for a bachelor party and just hang out and have wine and play golf, I'm all for that. Jack challenges him with getting out of his comfort zone, which is something I do. My girlfriend, I think, does really well at getting me out of my comfort zone.
Oh, interesting.
And I love that about her.
You call her your Jack?
She's definitely not my Jack, though. She's my Maya.
Okay.
Because then when Miles meets Maya, he blossoms. She pulls him out of his comfort zone. They are able to go walk around and have something in common. And then, you know, the big moment for Miles is she says, you have this bottle of wine. You need to go open that right now. He's waiting for a celebration.
Yes.
Anytime you open that is a celebration. Doesn't matter what it is. And so by the end of the movie, he opens that wine and drinks it by himself in a burger shop. And that is, and it's after everything.
It's a great scene, by the way.
It's such a great scene. And it's after he loses Maya because he was covering for his friend Jack. He was lying to her and she finds out and basically kicks him out after they've finally hooked up. And it's this cathartic moment at the end where he's like, he's like been saving this bottle of wine for so many years. He finally just opens it, and that he finishes it. He goes back to his life. He's a teacher. And then he just decides, you know what? He gets a call from Maya, and the movie ends with him just knocking on the door, taking a chance, and which was so unlike Miles, because he would have just given up and ran away. But he finally gets that call that says, I loved your book. There's so much pain in it, Miles. I can't believe it. Did you go through that, Miles? And you kind of learn that his book was almost autobiographical, where he loses his father and all these different things. So he's been through so much that by the end, he still dusts himself off and goes and takes a chance and knocks on her door, and the movie ends. And I just love that about Miles.
Now, since you identify so much with Miles, have you found, since you've fallen in love with Sideways, that you're trying to put pieces of yourself in any of your characters and anything you're writing?
Yes. In fact, I would say that the father of my main character in this new movie is me. Okay. And is a different version of me. It's like an older me with like some success behind him. But that success, like I find myself being able to go look at this character and go, I think I could fall. And this is a fault too. I look at this character and go, I think I could fall into this trap.
If you're not careful.
If I'm not careful. Yeah. This character makes, basically this character, his career takes over everything. He finds some success. He finds a lot of success actually pretty much overnight. And his family is suffering because he's so concerned about that. And that's a specific fault that I could identify. I do get sometimes with my girlfriend and I, it's like, put the phone down, let's enjoy life. And I can get so involved in my work that I'm just spinning it into a very extreme version of, I could see myself doing this. But then at the same point, London, my main female character, is me as well. And I see a lot of like what I went through when I was younger, when I was her age at 18. And like, so I do definitely put something like my script.
I think that's a great way to do it as well. And it helps you. I think it helps you in your writing as well, because it's funny because Ashley Robinson, who I co-write with a lot, when we were developing Jupiter Jet, for most of the series, when I'm writing Jupiter Jet's dialogue, I'm imagining a 16-year-old Ashley. And she denies it left and right, but I'm like, no, that's you.
Yes.
That is so you, it hurts.
It's absolutely true. And I would say that London, my main character right now, she's very sassy. And I started to, like, I'm 30 pages in, and I wrote this scene between her and her dad. And some lines came out, and I went, my God, that's my girlfriend.
Yeah.
Like the sass is
which, by the way,
strength.
I've always heard is a great writing trick from many writers, where it talks about, if you don't know how to write a certain character's dialogue, cast that character as like your uncle or your brother. And then suddenly the dialogue just flows because you know how your uncle sounds. You know how your son sounds, whatever, your dog.
That's a great note, Jason, because it's true.
Yeah.
If you can find at least one thing. Oh, hi, Cal.
Yep. Cal, the schmo dog just came in. Speaking of, he heard my mention of dog dialogue.
Yeah, all right. You need to stop tap dancing and sit. If you can cast the character, I've done it with actors too. So like,
yeah, that helps as well.
You can have an actor in your mind, and that kind of works too. Mm-hmm. Cal, get out of here.
All right, so let's move on. We got your favorite character.
Yeah.
I want to find out, what is your favorite? Now, this is going to be a prose book or a comic book.
Okay.
What is your favorite? Oh, what was going to be your other character? I'm sorry. We moved past that.
Easy. Luke Skywalker.
Okay.
Come on. I mean, everybody.
The hero's journey.
The hero's journey. Yep. Exactly. And I would even say, very controversial, that I think to see Luke's character go beyond Return of the Jedi and how he was handled in The Last Jedi is something that I'm still unpacking to this day.
I am too. Can we unpack it very briefly?
Yes, please.
I come down on the end that I don't like where, and this is spoilers for Last Jedi. I don't know how you haven't seen this movie at this point. Luke dies.
Right.
Luke disappears. We hope he becomes a Force ghost.
Yes. He becomes one of the Force. So I'm assuming he's going to come back in 9.
He pulls an Obi-Wan, a Qui-Gon, if you will, a Yoda. He disappears. He becomes Robes.
Yep.
I kind of feel that Luke in that movie being like, I'm not going to help you grow. I'm not going to train you, Rey.
Yeah.
I'm not bringing the Jedi back.
Yeah.
I'm done. I'm thinking about murdering my nephew, maybe. No, I'm not murdering my nephew. I kind of feel And we'll never know because Joseph Campbell never pushed the hero's journey further than just becoming the hero.
Exactly.
So we don't know what Joseph Campbell would have intended. But for me, I kind of feel that Luke's arc in Last Jedi is a sort of a betrayal of the hero's journey.
A lot of people think that.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of people think that. I'm not falling on that side.
Okay. How do you feel about it?
What I love is, I mean, Luke Skywalker... I grew up with Luke Skywalker. When I found out my dad almost named me Luke, I went around to all the neighbors and said, "You call me Luke from now on."
did they?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I remember specifically going next door and knocking on the door and saying, "My name is Luke now from now on." And my neighbor's like, "Okay, Luke." And I'm like, "I'll see ya. Okay, Luke. Bye." And she called me that for months.
I gotta go to Tashi Station.
Yeah,
bye.
Exactly. But what I love about Luke is his hero's journey is so succinct and perfect.
Yes.
And there's three versions of Luke. We have the New Hope Luke, where he's idealistic. He's looking to the stars. He wants off the planet. He wants adventure. But then he also is loyal to his family. He's like, "I can't leave. I gotta help my uncle Owen and Aunt Beru." And then the Empire kills them. And he's like, he has no choice. So Obi-Wan, I'm going to cross the threshold. I'm going to seek the call of adventure. And I'm going to listen to you, you old wizard that has the magic sword.
Yep.
And that's Joseph Campbell. So then he completes that hero's journey and blows up the Death Star. Then we get to Empire, and he's like, "Now I want to be a Jedi. Now I want to use my powers and save everybody." And Yoda's like, "No, don't go run off. That's Han and Leia, that's their journey. You can't meddle." And what does Luke do? He goes, "No, I'm going to go."
Yeah.
And he's not ready. And so he's brash. He jumps the gun. He's always looking to the future. Yoda always tells him, even in Last Jedi, you're always looking ahead. You're not focused on now. You're looking in the past. You're looking in the future. That's what Luke would always do. And then in Jedi, he finds that balance. He literally throws his lightsaber away and says, "I am not turning to the dark side. I am not going to kill my father."
While wearing black.
While wearing black.
I always love that.
But that journey in Return of the Jedi, I think, really has a lot to do with The Last Jedi.
Okay.
Because he, at that moment when he threw down the lightsaber, he chose the true Jedi path, which is pacifism, unless he's threatened. He's got to defend himself, but he's not going to attack. He's not going to, and he wants...
Which is something the Jedi all say during the prequel series, but they're fighting this war.
Yes.
And I know they were tricked into this war by Palpatine. But still, it is this thing of like, it doesn't... There is some times where the lightsaber doesn't jibe with the Jedi teachings.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting dynamic because you have the samurai influence in there, obviously, but which is a very similar kind of... not religion, but...
Yeah.
But I like that when... I like to think of the journey when Luke figures out I need to throw down my lightsaber and not kill my father. That's what actually saves him, because he didn't kill his father and turn to the dark side. Instead, he throws his lightsaber away, becomes defenseless, gets hit by the lightning with the Emperor, and that pulls his dad out of the darkness to save him. So his literal throwing down of a weapon caused this reaction to save himself. And so I do believe that that was his intentions in The Last Jedi. That he didn't, he force projected himself to give that spark of hope so that the Jedi could continue, because he literally is looking at, and look, a lot of people are talking like Luke wasn't handled correctly and all this. I would push back a little bit and say it's because Luke is the Obi-Wan of this movie.
Sure.
And Rey is the Luke, you know,
yes.
And it's Rey's journey. So what Luke does is for Rey, not for us. But he does it for Rey and the galaxy. But like I said, I'm still unpacking it, because what I like is I tend to think of things a little darker, too. I look at the reality of things, and Luke saw some shit.
Yeah.
And though he ignited
his... And we have no idea what he saw from Return of the Jedi to when Kylo blew up the temple.
I mean, if you're a canon junkie, I'm not really a canon junkie, but when I played Battlefront 2, there is a moment with Luke that you play as Luke, and he's very, and he's the Luke you all know, right? He's looking, he saves an Empire guy.
Can you spoil it?
Can I? I don't know. Can I spoil it?
Spoil it. I haven't played Battlefront 2 yet.
So I should actually not. Spoiler alert? Okay.
Spoil it for me.
There's a.
Spoiler alert for Battlefront 2.
Yeah. It's after Return of the Jedi. Yeah. The Empire is in chaos. You know, everybody's trying to figure out how to keep the Empire alive. And one of those characters gets trapped in a cave where Luke. It's like it was a cave that was that the Emperor put some Jedi artifacts in. Some bad juju, but some Jedi artifacts that Luke is investigating.
Okay.
And he ends up finding what he wanted, which is the compass.
Which you see in Last Jedi.
That's right.
Yeah.
You see that. But he starts working with this guy. He helps the Empire guy. And he gets him out, and the Empire guy's like, why did you save me? He goes, because you're a person. Like, and that's Luke, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't know. Then there's the canon junkies out there, and that's it. There's really no spoilers. Okay, he saves him. It's just
a, he finds a compass.
He finds a compass that shows up in The Last Jedi. So I'm still – the fact that Luke went so far as to turn away from everything and become a hermit.
And even turn the Force off.
And turn the Force off.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people are like, well, that's – you even mentioned that's counter to what Joseph Campbell did where he embraced the hero status. Now he's basically – did a complete 180 and became, you know, homeless Luke. And
he's hobo Luke.
And he just wants to die on that island. Mm-hmm. But at the last moment, he force projects himself to give that spark to the galaxy. There's something interesting in there for me that I still haven't unpacked yet.
Yeah.
I like it. I do. Mm-hmm. It made me sad. I mean, when I got out of Last Jedi, when I first saw it, I couldn't stop thinking about it. So trying to unpack that.
And that sometimes is a good story. Whether you hate it or like it, if you're still thinking about it, that means you're like, oh, there's a lot of depth there.
There is so much depth there. So to have the Luke that I grew up with and to have this Luke, he basically finds himself again by doing that and then goes out on his own terms. But it's the Jedi way.
Yeah.
He follows that Jedi because if he was trying to rebuild the order, and I don't know what it's like to lose. Not only he lost his nephew to the darkness, but his nephew then kills his best friend, tries to kill his sister, does all these things. So he's looking at himself as like, I'm failing again, just like all the Jedi did. So I'm going to take myself out of this. Mm-hmm. So I think as much as people don't agree with that, I think what Luke did is very selfless. He doesn't want to cause any more darkness. He doesn't want to see. Mm-hmm. He doesn't want to be like, I tried to do that. I tried to do what you said, Yoda, which is, you know, to pass on what you have learned, and it blew up again.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to pull myself out of that and say the Jedi needs to end. And then here comes Rey, and he senses something a little bit more pure in Rey than he did obviously in Ben. And he says it in the movie. He's like, the Jedi deserves somebody, you know, I'm paraphrasing, better.
Yeah.
And that's Rey. So now it's on Rey to rebuild the Jedi Order. Mm-hmm. And he's okay with that finally and is able to provide that spark for the galaxy because at the very end, the little kid's playing with the Luke Skywalker doll.
I actually really like that scene a lot.
Yeah. I love that scene because it shows, and it's a nice tie-in, that slave boy on Canto Bight is like a parallel to Anakin in my mind, you know, where we met him on Tatooine under Watto. So I love that mirror image kind of thing going, that there's a spark. Everybody's like, oh, the chosen one, and Rey needs to be connected to Luke somehow. It's like, well, Anakin was just, you know, obviously Lucas went for the Jesus reference and said he was just born in the Force, maybe. We don't know if it was Darth Plagueis or not, but he was just a random boy, you know. And then with Rey, and a lot of people hate that Rey didn't have any parents connected to Luke or Han or Leia.
I didn't mind that at all.
Yeah, I didn't mind it either. And it's her character because what Rian Johnson is saying is, no, she doesn't have famous parents to be special. She has drunk parents that sold her for money to drink, and yet you can save the galaxy. Meaning anybody, I don't care if you're special or if you have like these famous parents, if anybody can be special, anybody can go save the galaxy, and that's what I love. And to work in cahoots with Luke, I just love that. There's so much to unpack. I'm now finally starting to watch The Last Jedi more and more and more. So anyways.
We might have to bring you back on just to do a Jedi Last Jedi unpacking.
Yeah, no kidding, man. It's going to be crazy. So that's right. Luke is my favorite.
All right, so let's get to your second choice. Let's go favorite book or favorite comic book. What is one that really speaks to you? The story's really powerful, one that you take a lot of inspiration from, or I guess the best choice for a prose book or comic book that would be your favorite would be, what's the one you're constantly reading over and over again, like maybe once a year, or you never get tired of it?
I haven't read it in a very long time, but it's a book that I always reference, and that's The Alchemist by Paulo Coelho. I don't know if you ever read The Alchemist.
Know this book. Yeah.
It's a very, very, I call it like new religion, kind of in the vein of these, like, remember when The Secret came out and it was like this, like, everybody knows The Secret. This is more of a story that has a lot of, it's basically Luke's story too. It's a very mythological story, meaning he learns of this treasure and it's across the world, and he's going to go on this adventure, and he meets an Obi-Wan kind of character that gives him some help, and he keeps going on this journey. And then by the end, he realizes there's no treasure, and he goes, oh my God. And he goes back to where he was, And he was sitting on the treasure the whole time. That he finds out that the treasure was actually under the tree that he was sitting on the whole time. So he did this whole journey.
Interesting.
And learned so much about himself.
So would you say that the theme of this story is very much, you know, you're always around your treasure, or like, you know, don't go outward seeking your treasure, go inwards kind of an idea?
That's it too. Whatever you want, you can achieve by, there's a line in it that I always, the reason I bring up this book is because I always bring up this line, is that if you want something bad enough, the universe will conspire to help you achieve that. So like, if I want to be a writer, all of a sudden the universe will put forward a, like, this great new screenwriting competition has just been unveiled and it's right in your budget. And you go, oh, that's funny. I have this script that I just finished. So, or I just met this person. It's like, oh yeah, I'm starting this production company. There's little signs that the universe gives you to.
I agree with that, by the way. I really aspire to that. I think there are very much signs that the universe is telling you something.
Yes.
And if you don't pay attention to it, like I have a friend once who their dream was to act, be an actor.
Yeah.
And they kept getting paychecks to write for sites and do this other thing. And I was like, hey, that's the universe telling you, maybe you should write for, you should be a writer.
That's exactly.
Because they keep paying you to do it. Like, don't go against the universe.
Yes. That's what this story is. And I love, that's why I love it so much. I've read it probably 5 times in my life. Haven't read it probably in 4 or 5 years though, but it's always something.
But you own it, of course.
I own it. It actually sits on my toilet. I hate to say that, but it's kind of a reminder, you know, cause I'll sit there and open it up and get a little line here. You know, I've underlined things. And so that's my favorite book. And then honorable mentions, one that always stands out to me is a Stephen King book called 11-22-63.
That is an amazing book.
Yeah.
Yep.
I love that book so much. That's the pop reference that I read that book, and the love story in that is just so incredible, along with it, Stephen King telling a time travel story.
The amazing thing about 11-22-63, and I can talk about this a little bit, is that I did some research on it, like figuring out like how did he write this stuff like that. He hired his assistant for like an entire year to do nothing but research about the 1950s. And you can tell when you read that story, there's so many details about how the 1950s are different from current day. And I think it really helps make that story more powerful, because it does make that world seem more foreign.
Yes.
Because even though it's set in America, it's set in Texas.
Yeah.
But it seems like a completely different world.
Yes.
And it blows your mind even when you're reading it now, because you're just like, that was 60 years ago. It can't be of that year. But like reading that book, it feels like he has time traveled to an alien planet.
Yeah. It's so well done. I love the story. I love the sci-fi nature of it. That like there's like, you know, everybody knows with time travel, there can be like butterfly effects. If you change this, this will happen. And I love that deep dive of it. I love the relationship with it. I love the main character. It's one of those books that I was like, wow, I can't put this down. And, you know, when we're talking about this, I keep going to that book as one of my favorites of all time.
Oh, me too.
And as far as Stephen King.
And it's amazing with Stephen King, apparently, it's too, because that's a book that he did later in his life.
Yeah.
Like, not even during the height of King, which is, I would say, would be like Carrie and Cujo and The Stand.
Yeah, and It. Misery. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And like the first Dark Tower as well.
Yeah.
It was in that period.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, it came very late in the game. And I just finished his sequel to The Shining, Dr. Sleep.
Oh, I have not read that.
Oh, that's good. Mm-hmm. That's a good one, too.
Well, so what is it about Stephen King? You're a big Stephen King fan here.
Yeah.
You mentioned this one.
He's my favorite.
What is it about his writing that stands out to you? Like, what pulls you in?
You know, it's always just so damn creative. It's like, one is just the way he thinks of a story. Like, It is probably my favorite of his.
Really?
As far as like the layers of these characters. And like, I mean, I know people have seen the movie It and they think it's a killer clown or it takes the shape of whatever is, you know, you're scared of.
Yeah.
But It has a lot going with it, because it's like, it's not only an ancient evil. I mean, we're talking about this like cosmic kind of entity as well, because It is a monster, but there is... And I'm not going to spoil it if you haven't read the book. Have you read It?
I have.
Okay. You know what I'm talking about. The turtle.
But it's a pretty recent movie, so maybe not. You know. I don't know.
Yeah. So for me, Stephen King is it's always his characters. They pull you in, mm-hmm. And the concept and the way he tells his stories are, I don't know, they're accessible. They're just so much fun to read.
I would agree with you because there are some Stephen King stories that I think are fantastic. It's interesting. I think Stephen King, I don't know where I was going with this. Stephen King, I think, is a very good plotter, mm-hmm. with the exception of his endings, because he has some books that I think are amazing and fantastic and riveting, and every scene turn, you're so pulled in, mm-hmm. and then you get to that ending and you're like, that's the ending?
Yeah.
Well, like one of his best books ever, I think, is Under the Dome.
Oh, yeah.
Until the final scene.
You know what's funny about that? Mm. I never finished Under the Dome. I was getting into it, and then I don't know what happened. I just kind of put it down, and yeah that's interesting. Yeah. I wonder what is. I think I know what happens, though.
I'll tell you off the mic.
But, okay.
I think that is a. But he creates these amazing characters that really carry you through. Like, I think Roland. Mm-hmm. From the Dark Tower series is one of the best characters in all of fiction. I think he's so strong and so purposeful. And,
yeah, I only read the first book years ago, and I can't remember Jack. What.
All right, so let's get into your favorite movie, TV show, play. If you pick one of those three, I open it up because some people want plays, I've read.
Well, we've been doing, okay, so I have been thinking about this a lot. It changes every day, but I'm going to go favorite movie.
Okay.
And because of not only the characters, the story, but the filmmaking aspect of it, and that if that movie didn't work, I'm just going to say Jaws. Okay. Jaws is my favorite movie. Mm. And because if that movie doesn't work, we have no Steven Spielberg.
That's right.
So we wouldn't have an Indiana Jones. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't have an E.T. E.T. is probably a very close second and sometimes becomes my number one, mm-hmm. depending on the day. But Jaws is a masterclass in filmmaking, screenwriting, acting, studio interference, lack thereof, over budget, days overshooting, mm-hmm. editing, everything. If that movie doesn't work, Spielberg's gone. And we don't have, and so to kind of quote the 11/22/63, the butterfly effect would ripple out into the universe. One thing doesn't work in that movie, and it tanks at the box office. Mm-hmm. We have a different landscape of movies.
Well, that's such an interesting movie to pick because it is, you are correct, where it's like everything is firing on all cylinders. And especially when you go back to the script of that, mm-hmm. there's so much of that movie that you don't see the shark. It's called Jaws.
Yes.
And if it wasn't for Quinn, Brody,
Hooper,
thank you. I couldn't remember the other one.
Yeah.
If it wasn't for those three characters and those characters being so interesting, so different. That's the great thing about it. Those characters are all distinct. They're very distinct.
Yes.
Like Brody is like, I got to protect the family.
Yeah.
Like, I got to protect the family. Hooper's like, I got to see the shark science.
Yes.
And then Quinn's like, kill everything.
Kill everything. That's my white whale. Exactly. And that's what I love about it is that, and Brody is one of my favorite. I mean, I could put Brody up there too as one of my favorite all-time movie characters.
Really?
Yeah. Because I love that he says this. He's like, why are you afraid of the water? And he goes, drowning. And it's just, and he's so, mm-hmm. but he's basically a New York cop that moves to Amity with his family. And he's scared to death of the water.
Yeah.
And it's like, Martin, why'd you come to an island then? Mm-hmm. He's like, it's not an island when you're on it. You know, it doesn't look like an island when you're on it. But it's a very, like, nothing happens there. Mm-hmm. It's a very small town. He's able to, raise a family. And
he just wants to chill out,
He wants to chill out.
The biggest thing he wants is a parking ticket.
Yeah. And he's just like, I love the relationship. He wakes up in the morning. Where are the kids? They're in the yard. And it's like, on Amity, they say yad. And he goes, they're in the yad, not too far from the cat. And they just have this great chemistry with being a wife. Like, I love later on. It's like, you want to get drunk and fool around? Oh, yeah. Like, I love that they have this, wonderful little quaint life on Amity Island. And then it's literally man versus nature. Then this creature swims into its waters and kills a woman. And he's thrust into not only, it makes sense that this thing is in the water. He's scared to death of the water. Yep. And so now he's got to go, okay, it's a shark attack. Then it becomes man versus the government. Mm-hmm. And it's the town is like, no, this is, it's 4th of July. If you close the beaches, the whole thing dies.
And the movie, and that's the perfect thing about it, is why I think a lot of this script really sings, and the reason why we still remember it is everything you're talking about is the opposites. Yeah, your main character is afraid of water. Of course, your threat is in the water.
Yes.
And then he's a cop. And then the mayor's like, you can't shut down these beaches. Yes. So like at every turn, he tries to do something against the shark. It won't work.
It won't work.
In fact, I love the idea that Quinn gets taken out pretty early because he's supposed to be their epic shark hunter.
Yeah.
And so when these two dudes are on their own, there's like, we don't know how to move this boat. What are we doing?
Yeah. I mean, it's
great drama.
It's a perfect progression of story and character in that, like, you know, yeah. And you mentioned, I love that he's like, hey, I'm a cop. I'm going to shut the beaches. And the mayor's like, no, you're not. And then what happens? Shark eats another
shark
person.
Attack, yep.
And like the mother, like there's some one, like he knows about the shark attack with the girl. Don't close the beaches though. And so he's really, really worried. And we have that great scene on the beach where he sees the Kittner kid get eaten on the raft.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's like, oh my God. Then they're hunting for the shark. And then the mother in black comes and slaps him in the face because you knew a girl was killed on these beaches and you did nothing about it. But you actually know he tried to do it. So, but Brody gets the brunt of it and gets the blame of
because
it.
Because we want to feel it with Brody.
Exactly. Yeah. Our eyes are through Brody, and that's why I love Brody so much. So Jaws is just this masterclass of like the characters and how the script was written, and it wasn't that great. And then, you know, Peter Benchley wrote the book, which is completely different.
Way different.
It's so crazy different. Like, you know, they don't have a perfect marriage like it looks in the movie. You know, she actually cheats with Hooper, of all things, in the books. It's very weird.
But then the script, there's so many moments in that movie because what I think is one of the greatest scenes in all of film is when Quinn is telling the story of the Indianapolis.
Oh, yeah.
And apparently, and I could be wrong about this, that was written on set.
Yeah, there's a lot of history to that that I love. I think there's also... Oh, the name is, I don't want to say De Palma. Who is it? Oh, gosh. I can't remember, but he got some help rewriting. And then I think Quint, Robert Shaw wrote some of it as well.
Yeah, I heard that as well.
And that's the thing I love about
Shaw. Robert Shaw was actually serving in the Navy during that time.
Yeah. He kind of had an idea for it and like... He was drunk as well, I think.
He was really drunk.
He was like really drunk and had to show up and act, and he like nails the speech. But there's so many stories about Jaws that I love. If you haven't, for all you filmmaker buffs out there, read the Jaws log. That kind of gives you what happened. Like, that's why we have these signature Spielberg shots. Shark is made. Mm-hmm. Like, first they consider, we're going to train a shark.
Yeah, which I heard that.
Which I find hilarious in the 70s that the science wasn't there. I was like, you're not going to train a shark, buddy. You know, the shark is just an eating machine, like Cooper says, just full of instinct. It just splashing in the water attracts it. Blood in the water attracts it. You can't go sit, stay. So once that was out of the way, okay, we're going to build a shark. Okay, here's your shark. Okay, put it in the water. Sinks to the bottom of Nantucket Sound.
Of course.
And Spielberg says, and with it, I thought my film career, you know, because he's like, now what do? Okay, you don't see the shark. You have John Williams' iconic music, and it sets the stage. So Jaws becomes a horror movie, then a thriller, then an adventure movie by the end, because the music dictates that. To the end, when you're in the adventure, it's like, you know, they're like, you know, in the orca chasing the shark, and the shark, you know, is there because there are three yellow barrels and you only see the shark at like these different moments. And by the time he got there, I think Spielberg knew what he was doing and said, okay, I'm going to tease the shark here. You see the fin, you see just that great shot where he eats the guy on the boat, where you just see the shark face come up and then he's pulled down. And that's all you get. That's your first shot of the shark. And you're like, oh my God. And then when you see it through Brody's eyes, that leads to the most iconic line in that movie.
We're going
to
need a bigger boat. Yep.
That's like, and that's in a nutshell, that's the movie, you know. Brody is always in over his head. We're going to need a bigger boat. I'm being pushed back by the mayor and told to keep the beaches open. I'm afraid of water and there's a shark killing people.
Yeah.
What do I do? You know, Martin would be better suited for, you know, somebody holding up somebody at gunpoint. You know, he is not suited for this at all. And he almost dies because of it.
Yeah.
But he manages to save the day. Mm-hmm. Smile, you son of a bitch. And he's swimming back with Hooper. Is like, you know, I used to hate the water. I can't imagine why.
Yeah,
you know?
That's a great little end. Like, in a very soft ending.
Yes.
For this movie. But that movie, with all that tension, you need that soft ending. You need, mm-hmm. we kind of need that, like, chuckle fade.
Yeah.
We need that.
It's so great.
All right. So to end off this podcast, because I hope anybody that's listening to this is, you know, thinking about writing or thinking about creating stuff like that.
Please.
Mark Riley, I'm going to ask you the question that every writer, every creative gets asked.
Ooh. Okay.
Mark, I want to be a writer.
Mm.
What should I do?
Write every day.
Mm-hmm. Is that your main tenet?
Yeah. I think that as you start to discover your voice, you also need to read everything. Mm-hmm. I have found that my writing really flows when I'm reading a book. You know, like when you're reading a book.
Especially a good one.
Especially a good one. My brain was firing on all cylinders when I was reading Dr. Sleep recently because I couldn't put that book down. And so I felt very creative with it. But to start, like, start reading some of your favorite authors. Read Stephen King's On Writing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's a great, great book to read. If you are a screenwriter, read Robert McKay's Story. That's everything that starts. That's where you start, and then start writing. And don't be afraid to write a first script that is really, really terrible. Just get it done. Get it out there. You're going to learn so much from your failure. You're going to write. I mean, I probably have 15 scripts that never went anywhere, but that were so important for your journey as a writer. Because then what you're going to do is by writing every day and reading and discovering your voice. And when I say write every day, sometimes that's impossible to do. Sometimes
it is.
You can't.
It's very hard. I honestly admit I am not able to write every day.
Sometimes it doesn't
happen.
This past week, I wrote maybe a couple days. I didn't write every day. And I started this whole thing up by saying, I write every day.
Yep.
Not always. Sometimes you can't manage it. Sometimes you're on vacation. Sometimes
and don't let that kill you. Yeah.
Don't let it kill you. Don't let it bother you. Just write when you can. If you have moments, I think what really works is setting aside time every day. Like I did mention, the advice is true. If you can get yourself an hour every day, and if it's you write one word or one page or 10 pages or what have you, good. Then learn from that. And then as you get to your finish, like I just crossed 30 pages the other day and I went,
congrats.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And I went, oh my God.
Yeah, 30 pages.
And it's been, you know, it's been a couple months. So thankfully it's that. So write every day. Don't let it get you down. Learn from your failure. If your first script and you read it and nobody likes it, well, guess what? You can do it again. You can write another script. Just write what you know and write what you're passionate about. So that's the best advice I can give.
There you go. I think it's a great advice. Mark Riley, thanks for talking about writing with us.
Oh, thanks for having me. I love this. I'll do it anytime.
And that was my chat with Mark Riley. Thank you so much to Mark for joining me on the very first episode of Mythmakers. Go follow him on Twitter at RileyAround. And thanks to everyone that has become a Patreon over at patreon.com/Jawin because those patrons made this writing podcast possible. I'm Jason Inman, and I look forward to talking story with you in the future.